If anyone would like to make any comments or suggestions to change or amend the agenda, which we have before us, so this is the time to do it. Okay. As usual, I'll remind you to please turn off your cell phones or turn off the ringers anyways, and remind you also that try to take a break about every 90 minutes to stretch the legs, and it'll be a good time for you to return any phone calls that you do receive or need to make. Sally McGee.
I just had a question about the agenda item that's on Thursday at 11:30 when we're going to be talking about the agency's proposed rule on catch limits and accountability measures and how that is going to be incorporated into our groundfish discussion on Wednesday, or if it is, and what, if anything, we'll be able to take from, I mean, I don't know if we will be able to take anything from the Thursday discussion on the agency's proposed approach and apply it in Amendment 16, but if there's an opportunity to do that, I would suggest that we should.
Okay. At this point, I'm not sure that we even have a proposed rule to discuss. So this was put into the agenda with the idea that we would have a proposed rule available for the council to review or talk about. If we don't have one, I would assume that we'll probably receive a presentation that's something we've seen before, maybe updated a little bit, but certainly not. Without the proposed rule, we're still talking about interpretations. Paul Howard.
The other thing, Sally, is we've got our SSC going to meet in July to review the proposed rule and provide comments for the council. And also at that same time, they're going to review the groundfish amendment and give us advice on how the groundfish amendment is addressing ACLs.
Okay. Anything else on the agenda? Okay. We'll move right into reports. I have two items to report on. The first is that we did have our annual council chairs meeting last month, and we discussed a lot of the things that we've been discussing for about a year and a half, the ACL and AM guidelines, which we have yet to receive, the new NEPA Federal Register notice on or proposed notice on how to change or deal with NEPA or integrate NEPA and Magnuson, which we'll discuss later on. But quite frankly, there weren't a lot of notable discussions. There was a lot of rehashing of things we've been talking about for a year, year and a half. Out of that meeting, we also were tapped to chair or host the next meeting this upcoming year, and I think it's going to be in Boston in May. So the executive committee also met on June or May 29th. It's tab one, document number 10. We covered about 10 items. We were asked to consider, or an issue was brought to the executive committee on transshipments of herring to Canada. The executive committee did discuss the issue for about 15 minutes or so, and really, I think, was a bit confused as to what we were being asked to do. On the one hand, we, you know, and there's background information in this packet, enclosure number one. On the one hand, the regulations seem pretty clear on the process that needs to be followed. And on the other hand, we were getting conflicting information that wasn't documented. So the council executive committee thought that the spec process, which is something we're going to undertake soon, would be the appropriate place to talk about the allocation for transshipments that's in our specs. We also encouraged vessels to apply directly to NIMS or work directly with National Marine Fisheries Service on this issue. Paul Howard presented us with a budget, and I'm not sure it's in here. Is it in here, Paul?
Yes.
Closure number two. We reviewed that and approved it. Some of the notable discussion points that came out of that was the position we find ourselves in where we actually have a little bit extra money. So we took under advisement a suggestion from Paul that we contract out a ecosystem. We form an ecosystem committee and then contract out the writing of an ecosystem plan or document. And we also have or are contracting out some support staff for the skate amendment that's currently under development, social economic background work for the skate development plan. Let's see. We reviewed the timelines of herring, ground fish, and skates. Staff members that developed those plans were at the meeting to fill the executive committee in. There was discussion, considerable discussion, on the ground fish, focusing specifically on, from this meeting here until the end, the final vote, which was scheduled in October, how do we get from here to there? And there, under ground fish tomorrow, there will be a specific timeline that we can review and discuss. Essentially, what it does is it delays the process of going out to public hearings until after we have the GARM. And it also puts an additional council meeting in September so the council can receive the GARM findings and take a look at the alternatives that we have in place in front of us and make adjustments and then go out to the public. In a public hearing fashion, as opposed to doing it in June pre-GARM. But we can get into the details of that tomorrow. We discussed a council policy on how to address state fisheries when we set our ACLs in the federal plan. And there's some bold text there. I'll just read it quickly. To deduct an allowance for state catch based on recent history from a total ACL before we calculate the ACL for EEZ or other federally permitted vessels. The initial recommendations for an allowance for state waters catches currently are developed by the committees and the PDTs. So essentially, you're taking what you assume to be a state waters catch off the top before you set your ACL for federal fisheries. The fisheries stock status report to Congress is out, I believe, or it's in draft form. Enclosure number four, Paul Howard and staff brought to the executive committee's attention that their monkfish is still listed as overfished in 2007 and Georgia's Bank haddock as well. And we're arguing and fighting to change those designations because we seem to have some information. In fact, we approved a framework that updated the stock status for monkfish, but the bottom line was that the document wasn't improved in time. There's a internal cutoff date of the end of December. And whatever the status of the stock was at that point is how the determination is made for the annual report to Congress. So we're going to have to wait for the next quarterly report to get monkfish and haddock off the list. We had some discussions about advisory panel input and effectiveness. The executive director suggested that, at the very least, there are three critical points in the development of an FMP where AP should provide input, that being at the scoping level, the approving of alternatives for the plan, and then again at the final approval. We also had discussions about how we can intertwine APs directly into council meetings, either the day before or much like we're doing with the SSC. And so that's going to be on the next executive committee meeting. We're looking at timelines and intertwining our technical committees and our committee level work into the council meetings. We also reviewed staff comments on proposed guidance for the revised NEPA procedures and the IFQ referendums. You'll see those behind enclosure five. under the NEPA procedures, the executive committee made no recommendation with respect to the staff comments. And then under the IFQ referendum discussion, we agreed not to forward the staff comments for your consideration at this time. There's still some outstanding issues that we need to think a little bit more about. But in general, we want to make sure that there's maximum flexibility under that IFQ referendum so that plan by plan we can make adjustments and we don't box ourselves in. That was a summary basically of the executive committee meeting. Are there any questions? Okay, moving on. Paul Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple administrative things. For the information of the council, there is a GMRI reception tonight, which is very nice of them to sponsor that again this year. Secondly, there's a luncheon this Thursday for council members that are departing, Tom Hill and Jim Salisbury. We're going to try to institute some type of a luncheon when we do know of departing members. And also, I'd like to make note that Eric Smith is retiring, and you should RSVP if you want to attend his party by June 13th, and the party is June 27th. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, any questions for Paul? George Darcy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several items that I think might be of interest to the council. First, just a heads up that we are preparing a proposed rule, regulatory amendment that will probably be published this summer. It's basically a cleanup amendment. It will propose a couple of new prohibitions that just clarify existing measures, reorganize the prohibition section to hopefully make it more usable, both for the enforcement people and for the industry. Correct some inadvertent errors and omissions in the regs. Revise portions of the regs that relate to the VMS and reorganize those for greater clarity and standardize VMS unit and vendor requirements with the national VMS programs requirements. And I think you'll hear more about that during the enforcement report in a few minutes. I don't think it's a real meaty rule, but I bring it to your attention because it's possible that it could publish as a proposed rule and the comment period close prior to your next council meeting. So you might just want to look for that. On multi-species, we published a proposed rule in the Federal Register on April 29th that would establish an incidental monkfish catch limit of 50-pound tail weight per trip in the existing multi-species Gulf of Maine scallop dredge exemption area, the Southern New England scallop dredge exemption area, and the Great South Channel scallop dredge exemption area. We had consulted with the council on that prior to doing this. Comment period closed May 14th, and the final rule is under preparation. We expect that to publish within the next several weeks. We also published a proposed rule on May 20th that would allow use of the Eliminator Trawl and the regular B Days at Sea program and in the Eastern U.S. Canada Haddock Special Access Program. Comment period on that closes June 4th, which is tomorrow. And based on the comments, we'll make a decision as to whether to publish a final rule on that. Again, the council was involved in recommending that action. The closed area 2 yellowtail flounder SAP will not open this year. There's an allocation of zero trips based on a determination that the available tack of Georges Bank yellowtail is insufficient to support the minimum level of fishing activity within the closed area 2 yellowtail flounder SAP. And a final rule was filed last Friday, May 30th, in the Federal Register, and the rule published June 6th. An update on the Days at Sea leasing program thus far, from May 1st through May 30th, a total of 36 leases were processed and all 36 were approved. There were 66 distinct permits involved. The total number of days at sea leased was 1,336.33 at an average cost of about $511 per day at sea. Going to sea scallops, Amendment 11 was approved, and Framework 19 was also approved, and both became effective on June 1st, several days ago, with the exception that the new limited access general category scallop permits are not required until July 1st. It was necessary to push that back a little bit because both rulemakings were delayed more than we had wanted them to be, and that was to give people a little more time to get their permits. Amendment 11 established the mechanism for setting the scallop fishery specifications, including the new general access category, fishery and general category IFQ, and Framework 19 basically filled in the details of that, establishing the actual tax and the days at sea and trip allocations for 2008 and 2009. We've received approximately 300 applications for all categories of limited access general category scallop permits thus far, with the majority of them being for the IFQ scallop permits. On herring, we published a notice of intent to prepare the EIS for Amendment 4 to the FMP on May 8th, 2008, and the comment period on that action closes on June 30th. Monkfish, we published a final rule for Framework 5 to the FMP on April 28th, and that became effective May 1st. We're also preparing the proposed rule for Monkfish Framework 6. Framework 6 is the one that would remove the precautionary default backstop provision. Summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass, the 2008 recreational specifications were published on May 23rd. And became effective upon publication. Amendment 10 to the mackerel, squid, and butterfish FMP notice of availability for a draft supplemental EIS for Amendment 10, which is the butterfish rebuilding program, was published on May 2nd, and the comment period was scheduled to end on June 16th, but has been extended until June 23rd to allow the Mid-Atlantic Council, which meets next week, to complete their public hearings during the comment period. And that completes my report. Thank you.
Paul Howard.
George, I'm a little bit concerned about this regulatory amendment. This is the first we've heard of it, and you know, certainly you're talking about VMS and enforcement and things that the council's been talking about for years, trying, and we've got our own committee. Is this something that you've determined you don't need a scoping document and it's just technical? And if that's the case, how are we going to get, you know, I'm concerned that we should at least review something and work with you on, and the council know what's going to be in it before it, we don't even have, as you said, we might not even have a comment period that the council can look at it before our September meeting. So is there any way perhaps you could extend the comment period over through September so we could comment on it? Those are a number of questions. But first, do you have a categorical exclusion, no scoping or anything?
There is no scoping, no. Scoping is only for an EIS. I can't remember actually whether we're contemplating a CE or an EA. Do you remember, Gene? This is largely just a cleanup amendment. It's primarily clarifying some the wording of some prohibitions based on some of our enforcement attorneys who have had trouble making the cases based on the language that's in there, regrouping some of the prohibitions so they're easier for people to read. The one thing I think that has any substance at all is the VMS requirements, and Bill Simrow is going to give you some details on that in a few minutes. It's possible that depending on when it comes out, the comment period could be open, and certainly we could consider, you know, if you look at the rule and think that it's something the council would want to comment on, you know, I think we could consider extending that. But we really thought it was pretty administrative in nature.
Any other questions for George? NOAA General Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to give you an update on our lawsuits. We received a lawsuit last week in connection with Amendment 11 to the scallop FMP filed by 17 scallop fishermen primarily in the Mid-Atlantic region. The lawsuit has four basic claims. The first two claim basically an unconstitutional taking without due process in connection with this new limited access program. The complaint is very sketchy on details, and so I can't really say any more than that. Apparently, these apparently are probably fishermen that would not or apparently do not qualify for a limited access permit. The other two claims have to do with the old section 1853D with respect to individual fishing quota programs, which require the consideration of the report of the National Academy of Sciences, that the Council and the Secretary consider that report in adopting any new IFQ program, and that any new IFQ program provides for a fair and equitable initial allocation of individual quotas and considers the allocation of a portion of the annual harvest in the fishery for entry-level fishermen, small vessel owners, and crew members who do not hold or qualify for individual fishing programs. So that's the only new lawsuit we've had since the last council meeting. I'll bring you up to date on the others. We have been served with the motion for summary judgment and memorandum in support thereof in the lawsuit brought by New Hampshire and Massachusetts challenging Framework 42. The two main issues that were briefed in that motion had to do with the failure to consider and implement a mixed stock exception in Framework 42, and questions raised about the closed area model that was used to justify measures in Framework 42. The government's response to that motion is due on June 20th, and then we have additional times for reply briefs before the judge would actually consider the motion. And that would take it through the end of the summer for the motions, reply briefs, or at least through August. The other ongoing lawsuits that we have include the Midcoast lawsuit, which challenged which involved a petition for rulemaking to not allow midwater trawl vessels into groundfish closed areas. There was a petition for rulemaking back in the fall asking the government to take away the exception for midwater trawls to fish in the groundfish closed areas. The government denied that petition, and we've been sued based on that denial. We're in the midst of setting up briefing schedules, et cetera, for that lawsuit. Another lawsuit which challenged Amendment 1 to the Herring FMP, primarily the permit splitting provisions brought by Western Sea and others, Western Sea Fishing Vessel and others. We had a hearing before the court in that case. The court, in essence, stayed or dismissed without prejudice that case from the bench in response to an objection that we raised, the government raised, concerning the ripeness of the lawsuit, given that some of the plaintiffs had not yet been actually denied a permit based on the permit splitting provision. So the court said, well, I'm concerned about this issue. I'm going to basically set aside this lawsuit and but allow either of the parties to resurrect the lawsuit if things change. So the the court seemed to indicate that or imply that the plaintiff should try to perfect their claim by applying for and being denied a permit, if that was the result, and then perhaps petitioning the court for reconsideration of the lawsuit. So that lawsuit is sort of in limbo at this particular time. I think the final date for applying for a hearing permit was on May 31st, so we'll see what happens in that particular lawsuit. And then the last lawsuit that's pending regarding New England fisheries is a challenge by Oceana to the omnibus SBRM amendment. We filed the administrative record on that, and we are also waiting to set up briefing schedules for that particular lawsuit. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Gene? Dr. Weinberg, you ready?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to give a report on ships and then say a few words about stock assessment. First of all, the spring survey was complete. Was completed on May the 2nd. Slightly behind schedule due to some vessel mechanical issues, weather, and paired towing operations between the Bigelow and the Albatross. Regarding the calibration studies, the new vessel, the Bigelow, shadowed the Albatross during most of the spring survey as planned, and there were a couple of periods where the Bigelow had mechanical issues and couldn't be out there. But progress was very good this spring in gathering data for the calibration studies. They're currently completing the last of the planned towing experiments. These are essentially side-by-side kinds of studies where one vessel takes a tow and then the other vessel comes out before or after and tows in a very similar location. And they're doing this hundreds of times in different places to gather the data to get the calibration relationship between the two vessels for each species. And they're expecting by the end of the spring sampling period to have about 325 of these paired tows that will be used for doing this. And then these studies will continue into next fall as well. So although things got off to a very slow start with the Bigelow, now things are looking much better in terms of gathering the data that we need for the calibrations. The spring survey data will be released a little bit delayed because of all this extended work that was done with the Bigelow. Regarding the scallop survey, that survey will be conducted on the RV Hugh R. Sharp beginning on June the 21st. The survey will be conducted in two 18-day legs, concluding on August the 6th. Regarding the clam survey, that will be conducted on the NOAA ship Delaware II, beginning on June the 30th, and that survey will be conducted in three 12-day legs, concluding on August the 8th. A little bit about red tide sampling, that is for PSP. During both the scallop and the clam surveys, there will be some work done in conjunction with the FDA and the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, collecting some samples to study red tide. Moving on to stock assessment, we've had a number of three meetings so far related to the GARM 3. First, there was a data meeting in last fall, then there was a modeling meeting in February, and in late April, we completed the third meeting, which was on biological reference points. And following that meeting, the center sent up to the New England Council provisional biological reference points, which have been incorporated into the work that the PDT is doing. The other meeting that will occur is the final GARM meeting, where all of the 19 benchmark assessments, all the final results will come together. And that meeting will be in Woods Hole on the week of August the 4th. We have a couple of other meetings that are important to mention. There's a track meeting for Eastern Georges Bank Cod and Haddock on June the 23rd to the 27th. And a track for Georges Bank Yellowtail, also in Woods Hole, from August the 12th to the 14th. The provisional BRPs that were delivered to the council on May 12th, Paul Rago will be discussing those tomorrow morning at 8:30, so that's on your agenda. And also the SBRM prioritization table that was handed out at your April meeting. Paul will also be around today at 4 o'clock to discuss that. So that completes my report. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Any questions? Okay, moving on. Mid-Atlantic liaison report. There is not one. Okay. U.S. Coast Guard.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. This report's for April and May. We conducted 424 fisheries boardings. 83 vessels had safety violations. Only 9 of them were severe enough to send them home. Of those 424 boardings that we did, 22 had fisheries violations. So compliance remains about the same. There were 5 lives saved and regrettably 1 life lost. And lots of vessel casualties, 14 equipment casualties. We went out and towed 14 different boats home this time. 4 different casualties where the boats were lost. 1 was a collision, 2 were running aground and pending further investigation. And there were 8 sinkings at the dock. 8 different boats sank during this period. I've got some slides I'd like to show you, some pictures, show and tell. I don't know if you can see it that well, but this is the loss of life case that we had. It's the fishing vessel Save a Buck, and this was up off the coast of southern New Hampshire, northern Maine there. It's the timeline that goes with the case. Well, the case was run over 2 days. The vessel got underway at 10 o'clock one morning, got into trouble around 1500 in the afternoon, and we began searching the next morning when we realized it was lost. Survivors were found. 2 people were survived that being overcome by a big wave there, and we lost 1 person. Next slide. The following morning, after being notified, we went out and we conducted 8 different searches in the morning. It's just sort of one search pattern on top of another, on top of another, on top of another. Red ones are helicopters, blue ones are boats. Those are the searches we did in the afternoon. And you can see at that point, debris was beginning to wash ashore on the beaches down near Salisbury. And so we were shifting our search areas based on new information that was coming in. Next slide. It was a total of 13 searches. This goes back to the timeline of it, and you can see the little blue box in there. And even if you can't read everything that's on that slide, the little blue box represents the survivability time. That's from the Canadian Cold Water Survival Model, Canadian Exposure to Cold Water Survival Model. So when you pick this case apart, you see when the boat got underway, you see when the boat got into trouble, you see when those people could have survived, the time that they were in the water. And then the next day, all the search activity starts. So if you were to pick a case like this apart, you'd say, boy, you sure wish things had gone differently here. Number one, float plans are really important in you know, we harp float plans a lot to the recreational community, and when we talk to commercial guys, they say, oh, come on, I'm a professional. I don't need a float plan. But what a float plan does is it helps people ashore know when to call the Coast Guard, okay? If you file a float plan and you tell folks ashore when you're going to be back and you tell folks ashore when you want them to call the Coast Guard, it's going to help us come looking for you earlier. The second takeaway from this case is we have survivors from the Save a Buck, so they could tell a great story of a big wave coming in suddenly and overwhelming the boat like that. Nobody on the Save a Buck had any time to go get their survival gear. That was it. By the time they saw the wave coming, it overcame the boat and they were already in the water. So when you take your, you know, personal strategies for survival at sea, maybe like a lot of other survival systems, maybe they ought to be layered too. And the Gumby suits are what's really going to save you. But in this case, the guys were in the water that quick, right? So maybe you can add to your personal flotation devices. Maybe wearable gear is really a good idea. There's lots of new inflatable stuff out there that you wear like a pair of suspenders. The old excuses of it's uncomfortable or it gets in the way, you know, they're really fading. If these guys had wearable gear on, maybe we would have been able to get all three. But by the time you get in the water, by the time you've been in the water 3 or 4 minutes trying to find your survival gear, in water that's 45 or 50 degrees, it's kind of, your chances of a happy outcome are really diminished there. So two things to take away from the Save a Buck. One, file a float plan. Don't be afraid to call the Coast Guard. We don't consider it a hoax when somebody calls with a legitimate concern because they haven't heard from a boat that's supposed to be back at sea. We do it all the time. We start with communications. You know, we're happy to go to work for you and find your husbands or your sons or your daughters or whatever, okay? Call us early, and then think about maybe some wearable PFDs to take with you. Not so much to take with you, but to actually wear if you take with you. It just may be the difference if you find yourself suddenly in the water. Next slide. This one's a little crazier here. This is the Blue Sea. This is the second boat we lost this period. If you look at the big picture there, that's Coast Guard Station Point Judith. There's a big lighthouse there. This boat plowed up right on the beach, right in front of the Coast Guard Station on a clear night. Holy smokes, how'd you like to be the mate calling the skipper on that one, huh? You better come up to the pilot house. What happens there? When you add up all the costs of that, the boat's a total loss. There's $100,000 in salvage. There's all kinds of federal money spent on it that the owners of the boat ultimately are responsible for. That's a $1 million mistake. You see the diesel fuel in the water leaking out of the boat there? It's kind of the sheen around it. This is taken the next morning before the boat really began to break apart. How can stuff like that happen? Because we see this, no kidding, we see this like once every other month, right? We see a boat just goes aground. Perfectly good boat. What's really going on out there? Well, what's going on in the fishing industry is no different than what's going on in the rest of the maritime world. Next slide. Casualty causes. Listen, the logic on this slide flows counterclockwise. So start with me up there in the 1 o'clock position, that slide that's high and to the right. Causal factors for marine casualties. I don't know if you can read it, but the light blue says human factors cause 75% of marine casualties right now. Only 25% are because equipment's had trouble. Right? So most of the time when we have a collision or an elision or a grounding or a vessel's lost, it's a perfectly good boat, engine's running well, steering's fine, navigation systems are functioning. The people have made a mistake on the boat. If you take that across to the sort of 10 o'clock position, the slide that's high and to the left, if 75% of accidents are caused by human factors, when you start picking the human factors apart, you find that 75% of human factor problems are caused by fatigue. okay? Just plain old fatigue. So you had a well-trained person that knew what he was doing, that probably had done it before, that just plain old made, many times, an inexplicable mistake. How does that happen? Anybody in here ever been out? Come on, you can admit it now. Have you ever been out on the highway and taken a little micro nap behind the wheel late at night? Right? It happens on ships, too. So we know that 75% of accidents are caused by human factors, and 75% of the human factors are just plain old fatigue. That takes you to the slide that's in the middle and at the bottom there. And it tells you that basically 50%, 56%, more than half of all the accidents that we see have at the bottom root cause of the accident, when it's all picked apart, just plain old human fatigue. So if we take Blue Sea apart, maybe for lack of a nap, it's a $1 million mistake. Oh, I should say $1 million and rising at this point. Okay? So if you're out on the boat, you know, you really got to gauge your own physical condition, and you got to make sure you're in good shape before you sail it back into shoal water. Thanks. Next. Donna Marie. She sank out on the canyons, 120, 130 miles off of Cape Cod there. This actually was a case that went really well. We found the crew on the Donna Marie knew exactly what to do. They called the Coast Guard early. We got not only fishing boats moving towards them, but helicopters moving towards them and Coast Guard cutters moving towards them. And they evacuated that ship real nicely. And when we got on scene, they were in the life raft. The boat was still afloat at that point, but the boat went down within a couple of hours. Back up one there, Tony. We've got a movie with this one. Just stop it for a second so we can explain it. This is a FLIR movie, F-L-I-R. This is from the forward-looking infrared radar that's installed on the jets that we send out. And in a minute, you'll see the helicopter come in and do the rescue. So this film isn't from the helicopter, it's from the jet. When we have a offshore rescue like this that starts often with an E-perb, the first thing we do is we scramble a jet because it can get out there a heck of a lot faster, assess the situation for us, drop a life raft if it needs to, radio back to the helicopter what's going on. That way we know when we're leaving with the helicopter that we've got the right gear with us when we go. What you're looking at here, you can see this is the life raft from the boat right there. And that little guy, that's the head of the rescue swimmer. Again, this is infrared technology, so what you're looking at is heat signatures. Bodies inside the raft, and then the swimmer in the water. Go ahead and run it. The helicopter will come in from the left in a minute here. That heat signature you can see. You can see the water now being blown up by the helicopter's blades, and there it is at the top. Hanging from the helicopter right there is the rescue basket. Then there's a wire that comes down from that basket. The rescue swimmer's taken one of the guys out of the raft, brought him out away from the raft so that the raft doesn't interfere with the rescue basket, and then they'll pick him up. That's about all you get as a jet goes over you at 300 knots. Pretty quick view. Okay, next one. Alaska Ranger. You might have read about this in some of the trade papers. This happened up in Alaska. 5 lives lost, I think about 34 saved from this boat. Look at that herky thing sitting there at the dock. Who wouldn't be proud to own that in our fleet? Look at all the electronics on its mast. That's a big boat, 180-foot catcher processor. In good shape, operated by a professional crew, licenses involved, and that one sank too. And that really concerned us. We went on board, and the investigation isn't complete on it, but there's two things that we found in the initial investigation that worried us enough to put safety alerts out that apply to New England. One is the same thing that we found with Lady Luck. maintenance of material condition was not being done on these boats. So when they got themselves into an emergency situation and they went down below to close watertight hatches and scuttles, things weren't watertight. They were watertight 20 years ago, maybe, but the gaskets hadn't been maintained. Things were warped over time. Things rusted up. Things hadn't been tightened, and water was moving from one compartment to another. Progressive flooding is what eventually got it. And the second one about Alaska Ranger that bothered us a lot was when the crew initially found out they were in an emergent situation, they were way further into the emergency than they should have been to start taking initial action, because bilge alarms and high water alarms didn't function. Right? So there's great gear on the boats. You got to maintain it for it to work. And there's some vessel safety alerts Coast Guard wide that are out on it. I got 50 copies of this we've printed and put back on the table for you. Every one of you will read this and say, oh, yeah. Yeah, I got to go fix that on my boat. Every Coast Guard sailor is saying the same thing about his cutter, too, by the way. Right? But watertight integrity and high water bilge alarms really need to be tended to in order to give yourself the time to respond and prevent the sinkings. That's all I have, unless there's any questions.
Joe, any questions? Mike Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did the Save a Buck have an EPIRB? And if so, was it working?
No.
No EPIRB?
Not that we know of. With Save a Buck, I want to be very careful for anybody to take away validity or non-validity as safety gear. On Save a Buck, she flipped onto a rock. She flipped onto a shoal. So if she had it and it went off, great. If she had it and it didn't go off, you can't conclude that there's a problem with either her safety gear or with the safety gear system. The boat got wrecked, I mean, tragically, onto a shoal right away.
Dave Gaethel.
You know, I think Mike basically asked my question, but did it have a safety decal? Had it been inspected? Because the papers seem to have conflicting information on that.
Required safety gear was buoyant apparatus, which they had, immersion suits, which they had, life rings, an EPIRB, and a distress signal. Yeah, there was no EPIRB signal from her.
So did it have an inspection? Had it been a dockside inspection?
It had never had a dockside. Safety inspection.
Okay, because the papers, or at least some of the papers, seem to indicate that it had. That's why I was curious, because I didn't think you could pass one of those without an EPIRB. And the other thing I just wanted to say is, you know, from watching that video, I can't say enough about people who jump out of a perfectly good airplane to rescue somebody else. I mean, that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's the highest level of achievement there is in this world. It's just, those people are phenomenal.
Thanks. Those rescue swimmers are some really neat folks.
Anything further? Okay, thank you. NIMS Enforcement, VMS.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Andy Cohen, Special Agent in Charge of NOAA Office of Law Enforcement in the Northeast. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce Tim Donovan, who is my new Deputy Special Agent in Charge. Tim has been with us for a couple of months now, and if you call me at the office and I'm not available, either Tim or Mark Michelli, the other deputy, either of those guys will be happy to help you out. Boy, I don't know my own strength here. I did not distribute a quarterly enforcement report today because we're kind of in between quarters, but I do have an update for you. This update is since the last meeting in April. In that period of time, we seized approximately $138,000 worth of product in five separate catch seizures, and the Office of General Counsel has issued NOVAs in the amount of $102,000 and change Just last week, the NOAA administrator ruled on a case that we made against the Gloucester Seafood Display Auction back in 2004 for purchasing cod overages unlawfully. And the originally, the administrative law judge ruled in the auction's favor. There was a second respondent who was an employee of the auction. The agency appealed that decision, and the administrator upheld the agency's position to assess a $120,000 NOVA and a $22,500 NOVA against the employee. So what happens now is the case goes back to the administrative law judge for a final penalty to be set. In an unrelated case, we have recently completed an investigation again involving the Gloucester Seafood Display Auction and over 100 individual boats involved allegedly in buying and selling overages at the auction. The investigation has now been completed, and that will be referred to the Office of General Counsel for prosecutorial consideration. We had one large seizure in the Elephant Trunk closed area. The fishing vessel Miss Shauna falsely reported a hail weight, and that resulted in a $17,000 pound seizure of sea scallops, and that was valued at over $126,000. I've been briefing you on a conspiracy that we've investigated involving mislabeling of Vietnamese catfish that was being imported unlawfully into the United States and sold as wild-caught snapper, grouper, yellowtail, flounder, and other products, seriously undermining the efforts of the fishing industry. A 27th defendant is now considering pleading guilty prior to indictment. And in the world of criminal investigations, if a defendant, actually he's not a defendant, he's a suspect because he hasn't been charged yet. If a suspect decides to plead guilty prior to being indicted, it doesn't get any better than that. It means that the investigation was right on in what we suspected. The suspect agrees with that and wants to put it behind him. So I will keep you briefed on that. There are a number of trials in that conspiracy still scheduled for October this year. Whether or not other people will plead guilty and corporations is, of course, remains to be seen. We had a hearing scheduled today on the fishing vessel Wizard, which was a VMS non-reporting case. And last night, on the eve of trial, the case settled, so we are not going to hearing. And the settlement terms are as follows. The owner must sell the boat. 30% of the proceeds will be forfeited as a penalty. That's about $16,000. The owner is out of the federal fishery for 4 years and out of all state fisheries for 2 years. And the operator of the Wizard is out of federal fisheries for 5 years, out of state fisheries for 3 years, and must pay a $1,200 fine, or penalty, to be more accurate. And one of the crew members on board is going to face a 90-day permit sanction and a $750 fine. That concludes my portion of the report. Bill Semereau, the VMS manager, is going to brief you on VMS. I'd be happy to take any questions now or after Bill concludes.
Before Bill goes, any questions for Andy? Dave Gatham?
Yeah, it's not so much a question. It's as long as he's here and I got everybody from the states are here as well. I had three phone calls at home and four or five on the radio in March and April about lobster gear, specifically a growing problem in an area from Boone Island to the Western Gulf of Maine closed area to Cape Ann, specifically illegal marking of gear. You know, people either not marking it at all or using little tiny buoys and 20 trap trawls that you can't possibly see. There are federal marking requirements. The gear is not whale safe. I dragged up one thing myself with an observer on board that had 5/8 braided nylon rope on it for ground line. You can't part that with a tugboat. I mean, you know, this is just people using whatever rope they could find. No tags. Appears to be a sad situation where people are stealing gear, according to some of the calls I got, and then cutting the tags out of it. And they put two of their own tags on the first two traps on each end. So if by some chance somebody hauls it up and checks something, they see a tag. But the 15 or 16 in the middle got nothing. Use of cod for bait, whole cod, not the kind of cod you catch in a lobster trap. These were cod that wouldn't fit through the head. So either fishing, you know, some kind of gear to catch the cod or getting overages off of boats or something. The cod came from someplace. They didn't get in the traps by themselves. You know, they still had the guts in them. We've also had the last 2 years at the co-op, people offering to buy unused trap tags now for $10 to $15 a piece. So it appears that there's somebody's figured out that as long as it's got a tag in it, nobody checks the number to see if it's your tag. As I said, trap theft. This was a number of lobster individuals called us where all of a sudden trawls would disappear out of areas where nobody was dragging or no mobile gear activated or anything. You know, basically in the middle of hard bottom or something, two or three trawls would just be gone and they grapple and there was just nothing there. Also, no biodegradable hog rings in the escape panel. A lot of the old traps we're dragging up, we find two or three dead lobsters in them. The gear keeps fishing even with no bait in it. You can tell if you put a magnet on it whether it's whether it's steel or not, and will rot away. Stainless steel will be there forever; it doesn't come apart. Let's see, what else did I have here? Basically violation of every lobster law you could think of. These boats seem to be coming from quite a distance away. The local boats are obviously the ones that were complaining to us. Boats from New Hampshire and Southern Maine. They felt that the boats were coming from, 90 miles to the north or maybe 60 miles to the south. They don't see the boats. The boats are either hauling the gear at night or late in the afternoon. But it's all over the place. In March and April, it was virtually unfishable in that area because you never knew where it was going to be. You'd set out and the boat would just stop. We had one guy who ended up with a net and a wheel, a pretty powerful boat. There was so much strain on it that it pulled the boat backwards. When he brought the doors up, the net came up underneath the boat while they were trying to get themselves free and ended up with a net and a wheel, which is a pretty serious safety situation. So anyway, I just wanted to call attention to the state directives and to enforcement while everybody's at the table this morning that there's, at least in this area, a problem that was insignificant 3 years ago has become very significant this year. It seems to be growing very rapidly.
Andy?
Dave, thanks for bringing that up, because I omitted one item I should have mentioned before, so thanks for the reminder. Recently, a fellow named Aaron Marconi received a six-month suspended jail sentence in New Hampshire for theft of lobster gear. He will have to pay a $6,000 fine. He didn't have a landing permit, and he's now ineligible for one for the next 2 years. In addition to which, the gear was not dam compliant. That was the state half of the case. We attended the hearing. It was a joint case done by New Hampshire and my agency. And now federal charges will be filed separately.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up to you, David. Maine Marine Patrol has a very aggressive at-sea enforcement program funded through a joint law enforcement agreement with the Fed. So in the event that no one dropped a dime, which is generally what they need to pursue investigation that far offshore on untagged and unmarked gear, call me and I'll work it out with you.
I appreciate that. I know you have an aggressive enforcement plan. The lobster industry itself, I mean, people called me at home. They didn't want to call on the radio, even though we were trying to find out who owned the gear. If you're a fixed-gear fisherman, it's extremely risky to get involved in so-called dropping a dime. I mean, like you said, gear's disappearing now without people dropping dimes. If somebody finds out you're the guy who tabbed them and your 800 traps are being fished somewhere else overnight, So I think it's going to take a much more concerted effort by the states. I mean, I know New Hampshire sent a boat out because I reported it to Doug. You know, there is very little enforcement of fixed gear work other than what the states do. You know, I have never seen a Coast Guard cutter with a potholder on it. They can only get what a guy happens to have when they come by. And these guys know if they see a boat coming on the horizon, they just cut it loose while they're hauling and shove the rest over. And they go pick up, you know, they always leave a trawl in the area that's legal. I mean, this is going to take that's why I brought it up. It's going to take a concerted effort for enforcement. It's going to take, you know, more than one or two boats with pothaulers on them to go out here and haul substantial amounts of gear and check it for compliance.
Let's talk offline.
Okay. Frank Blount.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Andy, could you go back to what you said? I think I heard part of it, and was it about the seafood auction? Did you say there was 100 boats being investigated?
It's my understanding there's over 100 boats.
Thank you.
Jim Allen.
Yeah, at the last meeting, you gave us a report on the, I can't think of the name of the case in New Bedford where about $1 million cash was taken out of the banks, and I asked you if there was $1 million of cash spent, there was overages, and had any boats been prosecuted in that case, and you want to get back to me? I was wondering.
Yes, the boats were not, we looked into that, and the boats are not going to be prosecuted.
Anything further? Okay, Bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, council members. I'm Bill Semro, the Northeast VMS Program Manager for the Office of Law Enforcement in Gloucester. The VMS team is currently monitoring 1,483 vessels by vendor. It's 727 SkyMate, 717 Boat Tracks, and 39 Tron and Tron. The VMS population is about 100 fewer vessels than this time last year, by the way. With regard to Scallop Framework 11, at the last council meeting, I reported to you that the next VMS software rollout would occur on June the 1st. That rollout's been delayed until July 1st, when the new limited access general category permits are issued. All three new LAGC permit categories require the vessel to carry a VMS unit. And the VMS vendors are currently programming the new changes, and we expect to test their software within the next couple of weeks. Once the software is approved, SkyMate will mail out the new discs during the week of June the 23rd, while Boatrax and Tron will perform an over-the-air update on June 30th. The changes to the Northeast forms include on the Scallop declaration screen a new Northern Gulf of Maine declaration, which is added for both the LAGC for the LAGC trips, and the Hudson Canyon declaration is deleted from both the LAGC and the limited access trip declarations since that area closed on June 1. On the Scallop catch report screen, we've added some instructions on how to use the form, just for some clarification. And we've deleted the observer catch data fields as directed by SFD. On the Scallop broken trip notification form, instructions were added there as well, and two additional data fields were added requiring the user to fill in the operator's name and also the time that they terminate their fishing in the access area. And finally, a new Scallop pre-landing notification form has been added to the forms package, and that's required to be submitted by all IFQ and Northern Gulf of Maine permitted vessels. I expect within the next week I'll post a copy of all the new Scallop VMS forms on our VMS webpage on the NERO website. Turning to the VMS reimbursement program for a moment, an update on the program was published by NIMS Headquarters OLE in the Federal Register on May the 6th. The update supersedes all previous reimbursement notices, and it does provide a complete instructions on the eligibility and application process. A copy of the notice is available on our VMS webpage. And owners should be aware that NIMS will no longer reimburse for units that were placed into service prior to July 5, 2006. And Scallop Amendment 11 is eligible for reimbursement. The reimbursement, of course, is for the purchase price of the VMS. It doesn't cover installation or the monthly costs. With regard to the revised VMS standards for VMS vendors, at the last council meeting, I stated that NIMS headquarters OLE had published revised VMS standards for vendors in the Federal Register on January 31st. As George Darcy mentioned in his report earlier, the Northeast region intends to specifically adopt and cite these standards in a proposed change to the VMS requirements in the Northeast regs. Quite frankly, the VMS requirements for vendors in the Northeast regs at 648.9 are outdated. And the standards published by NIFS headquarters for vendors is far and away more comprehensive than anything that is covered in our regs currently. So these actions will standardize the VMS vendor requirements throughout NIMS. The regional administrator for the Northeast region continues to retain VMS vendor approval authority for the Northeast region. And previously approved VMS vendors and new vendors seeking Northeast approval would be required to maintain or meet the new standards, as well as any specific Northeast requirements, essentially the Northeast Forms package. So how does all this affect VMS vessel owners? Well, previously installed VMS units that no longer meet the standards will continue to be approved until the end of their service life. So you'll not be required to run out and buy a new VMS. That unit you have on the vessel will be good until it has to be replaced. Owners who replace their VMS and new owners would be required to install a unit from one of the approved vendors that meets all the new standards. As such, the replacement unit may be a different model than the one being replaced. I can tell you that existing SkyMate and Boatrax units don't meet all the new requirements. SkyMate has developed a new SM250 VMS. It's basically a one-piece unit that meets the requirements, and Boatrax is currently investigating new technology. Along with the effort to adopt the new VMS standards, and as George had pointed out, the region is in the process of updating the Northeast VMS regulations for vessel owners. The proposed changes include reorganizing the VMS requirements by creating a section applicable to vendors at 648.9 and another section which would be applicable to vessel owners at 648.10. Secondly, requiring owners who install a new or replacement unit to call the Northeast VMS team to verify connectivity with NIMS before taking their next trip. We found this action to be necessary because a vessel's VMS may be activated with the vendor, but is yet to be registered and reporting its position to NIMS. So ensuring that NIMS is receiving a signal before the first trip is to both the industry and OLE's benefit. Third, reorganizing the prohibition section to make them clearer to the user by grouping them for each FMP, titling the sections and subsections, providing more guidance on finding specific prohibitions, and adding a prohibition clarifying that it is a violation to provide a VMS declaration that does not reflect the intended fishing activity. Fourth, reinstating some of the Framework 42 correction rule provisions that pertain to VMS that were apparently inadvertently deleted when Framework 1, the Surf Clam Ocean Quahog FMP, was published. And finally, adding a new VMS demarcation line coordinate in order to include Monhegan Island, Maine, within the demarcation line for easier days at sea trip reporting through VMS. This is for vessels that originate trips from the island. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman. Any questions?
Thanks, Bill. I have a question. Yesterday I attended the Ground Fish Committee meeting. I don't believe you were there. I didn't see you there.
No, I wasn't.
There was some discussion about different alternatives, and the question came out of the regional office staff. Well, how is this going to work, and how are you going to account for this and that? And my recollection was a discussion centered on, well, we can utilize VMS to accomplish that accounting. And the regional office staff said that there were some internal discussions going on. I think you started to sort of touch on them here, that indicated that at least one or two of the units, I think she said it was boat tracks, are at the limit of how many lines they can communicate. Is that, am I getting that right? I mean, are we at the point where we can't do anything else with VMS?
Yeah, you bring up a very good point, John. I'm glad to touch on that. Yeah, Sue Murphy and I had a conversation about this before the Groundfish Committee meeting, I guess on Monday. And of the 700-plus boat tracks units in the Northeast Fleet, there are 48 that are old units that are limited to 600 lines of text. So for anybody that has a boat tracks unit and you go into your macros, you count the individual lines of text across all macros in a Northeast Forms package. With Scallop Amendment 11, we're running up to about 580-something lines out of 600. So we're maxed out just about on those 48 units. The other 650 units or so are limited to 800 lines. So they have 200 additional lines. So we've got to do something with those 48 units, particularly if, you know, we're looking at making changes in the future. Amendment 16, for example, what can we do? We won't be able to make any changes on the boat tracks with those boat tracks units. So what I've done is two things. I'm pursuing two avenues. Number one, talking to headquarters, National VMS Program Manager John Pinkerton, to find out if we might be able to use reimbursement money to upgrade those units from 600 lines to 800 lines. The other avenue of approach is I've talked to Boatrax, their general manager last week, Patrick Sullivan. He's going to Qualcomm, it's a Qualcomm unit that they use, and see what can be done to replace the firmware to upgrade the units to 800 lines. Those are the two approaches I'm looking at right now.
Well, I'm glad you're working on that. I didn't realize, Sue didn't say it was only 48 units. Is that?
48 units, yeah.
That are the older units that are held to 600 lines. I'm glad you're working on some solutions, because I got the sense from the dialogue yesterday that we could be facing a limitation on what we can do in terms of utilizing VMS. So I'm glad you're working on that. Any questions for Bill? Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, obviously this is going to cause a lot of angst in the industry. Is we try to explain this. I actually got a couple calls from people that heard a rumor that, you know, their units weren't going to be any good anymore, and, you know, how am I going to pay for a new one and all this kind of stuff. And apparently I somewhat lied to people, because I said, no, that's not true, that if you've got a unit, it is good, and you say it is good until it breaks. Well, when it breaks, they're going to have to buy a new one now. And I think you sort of answered the question to John, but is there going to be a provision to use any of this federal assistance money for them to replace these units when they break? Because, you know, most people right now, I mean, at least in Groundfish, you know, I just paid $4.50 for fuel. I mean, I don't think there's anybody going to have any money left to do anything after they pay the fuel guy anyway. So, you know, this is just another straw on top of the pile.
Yeah, Dave, another good question. I have raised that with the National VMS manager, and the response I got was that for replacement units, they would not reimburse. It's a one-time reimbursement per vessel, but they would not. Unless there's a new requirement that comes down the road that requires them to, you know, change that unit out. Not replace it, but because there's a new regulation that comes into effect that says that unit is no longer, you know, meets the requirement.
Okay, because I think at least in the 48 units that were mentioned, they were probably purchased prior to this reimbursement program and were never eligible for it in the first place. I mean, I know the one I have, I didn't ever get reimbursed for it because I bought it outside the window. So, you know, is it a kind of a one-time thing? You can be reimbursed once for a unit, or is that what it says?
That's essentially it.
One-time reimbursement. So if these people had never been reimbursed, then they could conceivably be reimbursed for having to replace these units that only have the 600 lines of text or whatever.
No. Unfortunately, no. Let me clarify. You know, the reimbursement obviously covers certain regulations that were implemented since 2006. So, I mean, you're right. You're probably, you know, there are vessels that have had a VMS well before 06. that didn't qualify. And the question is, will they now be qualified to replace their unit qualify for reimbursement? The answer, as I understand it, is no, they would not.
It would seem to me, though, Bill, under that vein, if the council and the service are implementing regulations that are becoming more complicated or putting more of a drain on VMS units, and members of the industry are in possession of units that can't comply with those, that they should qualify for a reimbursement to update their units. But that's a separate issue for another discussion. Anything further for Bill?
I'll just add, John, I understand the concern, I believe me. You know, and I make these kinds of concerns known, but it is a national program. It is not run by each NIMS region. It is run nationwide. So
I understand. It's not a criticism of you, Bill. It's just a statement. Okay, thank you. Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, behind tab one, document number one, is a meeting summary. I'm not going to present it, but if anyone from the Dr. Pierce.
Thank you, John. With John Nelson no longer being with us, I guess various state directors will tag team this effort, that is to provide the council with a briefing as to what goes on with Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And in this particular case, I'm referencing a four-day meeting that was held in May in Alexandria, Virginia. The majority of the boards that met dealt with species and issues that were not of concern, are not of concern to this council, but I will highlight a couple of decisions that were made and some issues that were raised that are relevant to this council, as well as the Mid-Atlantic Council. There were 9 board meetings, 2 committee meetings, as well as the policy board and executive committee that met. And frankly, I continue to be amazed that the policy boards get their business done in 3 to 4 hours, sometimes 2 hours. I don't know whether that means they're more efficient than this council in terms of our committee meetings that go on. It seems forever, or maybe the issues are not as complex. I yet to have been able to figure that one out. Anyways, we had a great deal of discussion with summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass on commercial and recreational allocations. And although this council doesn't deal with those three species, clearly they are New England species. Southern New England specifically, although with the way the climate seems to be changing, eventually there'll be species of interest to the state of Maine. I think black sea bass has already made its way up here in significant numbers. There were two motions made relative to changing the commercial and recreational allocation for summer flounder and for scup. And those motions to make a change in the allocations failed. And I only raise that to highlight the fact that this council is dealing with commercial recreational allocations, specifically Gulf of Maine haddock and Gulf of Maine cod. Of course, there are other allocations we'll be dealing with as well. So the council should learn from the fact that ASMFC has a lot of history with these sorts of splits, commercial and recreational, extremely contentious, and once they're set, they're extremely difficult to change, regardless of any good reasons as to why the ratio should be changed. So groundfish, we need to give some thought to that. Once they're set, they tend to be set. Shad and river herring, the management board did meet, and the only point I'll raise here is that the shad and river herring management board is quite concerned about and sensitive to the issue of bycatch of shad and river herring in the pelagic fisheries, notably the sea herring fishery as well as the mackerel fishery. And it was a good step was taken by the management board to include as advisors a number of individuals, two that I note that are very specific to the sea herring and the mackerel fishery. That's David Ellington from Gloucester and Jeff Reichel from New Jersey. They and other advisors will be extremely useful, helpful in dealing with the question of how to grapple with bycatch of shad and river herring in those pelagic fisheries. The other, the Management and Science Committee is an extremely important committee for ASMFC function, and I would encourage council staff in particular to pay attention to some of their deliberations, because they do a lot of good work, and the research issues that they get involved in, the science issues that they get involved in, do overlap with council responsibility and interests. And sharing information, I suspect, would be of great use through formal exchange of information between the committee and council staffs. For example, the Management and Science Committee is now working on a major task regarding acquiring information on forage fish of concern on the Atlantic coast and how that information might be used in FMPs or models. They do a lot of modeling work, evaluations of models that relate to forage, ecosystem-based issues that this council should be aware of. Spiny dogfish and coastal sharks. Quite a bit of discussion about coastal sharks. I won't touch on that. However, there were two motions made and votes taken that relate to spiny dogfish that will have to be eventually addressed by the Mid-Atlantic Council and this council, and that is, number one, the ASMFC decided to go with an addendum to change the management plan to do away with the seasonal splits in the spiny dogfish quota and to remain with regional splits in the quota. Right now, the council's work with seasonal splits, not regional. Regional make a lot more sense than seasonal. I'm hopeful that this council on the Mid will eventually go along with that ASMFC strategy to remove the seasonal, go with the aerial, and perhaps to then follow the lead of ASMFC with another decision that was made, and that is to pursue state-by-state quotas for spiny dogfish. That will eventually, assuming it eventually moves forward and is adopted, that'll resolve a lot of allocation issues that relate to spiny dogfish. And then finally, I think it's finally, on sea herring. On sea herring, there was no meeting of the sea herring section. However, there was discussion about how ASMFC needs to improve its interaction with the New England Council on Sea Herring Management. In particular, I'll draw your attention to tab number 5, number 6, and that is a letter that was sent from George LaPointe, chair of ASMFC, to John, our chair, relative to a need for increased coordination of ASMFC with the New England Council regarding sea herring issues, since it's obvious that there's a significant overlap in ASMFC and council interests, specifically ACLs, AMs, sectors, monitoring the fisheries to take a look at bycatch issues. That has to be done, and that's the tone of the content of the letter from George, that he's asking for a way to facilitate longer-term planning, and he wants that you, John, and George to meet with the executive directors from the council and the commission to discuss the most effective and efficient approach for coordinating our future efforts. So that letter is in the binder. Relative to sea herring, not at the meeting, but this summer, maybe even earlier than the summer, we're almost at the summer, the New England states, actually the Gulf of Maine states, Maine, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts, are continuing to work closely with each other relative to the Area 1A quota. We monitor it, working with the National Marine Fisheries Service, and we attempt to slow down the taking of the 1A quota through individual state efforts, independent of the council. And those efforts involve working with the fishing industry to have days out of the fishery, no fishing days. So that meeting will be held sometime very soon, I suspect, depending upon how quickly the 1A quota is taken, and then the states will then react with some additional state restrictions to slow down catch, if indeed that is necessary. In addition, there'll be a meeting, if it already hasn't occurred, with Pat Kirkle's office to continue our discussions with her staff relative to timely and accurate reporting of sea herring landings. Last year, there was a bit of a snafu. I won't get into the specifics, but I believe we dealt with the problem of opening and closing the fishery using information provided by the service, and we're hopeful that the continued meetings we have with Pat's office will enable us to, again, be very timely with our monitoring of the landing so that the states can respond and slow down the landing of the Area 1A quota. So that concludes my report of what occurred at the ASMFC meeting.
Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick follow-up to David's complete report. One is that I've spoken with Hannah Goodall, and we're going to be having that meeting with the agency sometime before the end of June. And what David modestly neglected to report is that he was a recipient of the Commission's annual Award of Excellence for Management and Policy, and recognized and thanked by the Commission.
Dr. Dog.
Since he mentioned it, thank you. Two other individuals received an award of excellence, and their involvement in interstate management is described in the summary of the ASMFC meeting, and I'll only highlight the fact that a member of our staff, the Division of Marine Fisheries staff, received an award. That's Dr. Gary Nelson, who's done a tremendous amount of work regarding striped bass, a number of other species as well. And one of the points that I should highlight relative to his contribution to the region, the science in the region, is the fact that he's quite involved with the Commission's Advanced Stock Assessment Training Series. And that training is critical for our getting state scientists in particular on the same page, so to speak, and up to date as to how they can best work with their colleagues to improve the stock assessments that ASMFC relies on. In addition, Sergeant Ethia from Rhode Island, she received an award, law enforcement specifically, and it relates to her spearheading quite a number of investigations that relate to monkfish violations and spiny dogfish violations, working with NOAA special agents and Connecticut agents as well. She was involved in the issuance of three separate notices of violation and assessments in the amount of $1.2 million. So she's been quite active, and that's one reason why she received that award.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, can you give us a little bit more information concerning the question of revisiting the summer flounder scup allocations? As you pointed out, we're dealing with this under Amendment 16 right now. The committee has put into the recommendations what was felt to be a mechanism to revisit this allocation as the Marine Recreational Information Program is developed to replace the MRFs program, and we get a better handle on what the actual catches are in the recreational sector. There has been some concern that even though we have that mechanism in there, it will be very difficult to revisit that. I mean, you indicated that. And I'm just wondering what some of the background discussion on why it was decided not to revisit this. Is it too difficult? People just don't want to, you know, get back into that allocation discussion? Or, you know, was there something that we can learn from in the discussions that went on at ASMFC concerning that?
I think it comes down to those who have something want to keep that something, and those who want to receive that which someone has find it very difficult to get it. This has been the split between the commercial and the recreational fishery on fluke and sea bass has been controversial and has been discussed off and on for many years. And I think that the groundfish committee's approach is a very good one, and I think that it makes sense for us to move forward in that direction. However, you're quite right that even with a procedure that's established, it will be difficult to make changes since, again, you're pitting commercial fishermen against recreational fishermen, and someone has to give in order for someone to get. And I think it's just safe to say that that's despite the good arguments for making changes, especially in the SCUP recreational split, which I think is 78% commercial and 22% recreational, you know, it just didn't fly. And the Fluke is 60-40, and once again, you know, that was not changed either, despite some very, you know, good and logical arguments for us revisiting it and making some changes, even if those changes are modest. So I have no wisdom to reveal, no real insights to provide. It's just simple matter of competition for fish.
How many, Dr. Pierce, how many tons of scup would you have to trade for a ton of fluke?
I'm unwilling to trade.
Okay. There's the problem. All right, anything else under ASMFC? Okay, we're going to move into our next agenda item. I believe Chris is going to present the experimental fishery permit applications or comment periods that are currently open to the council, and we'll see if anyone wishes to comment on them.